You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent this morning, and I'm betting we all have a horror story or two about buying something based on an online review, only to be left terribly disappointed and wondering what in the world those online reviewers were thinking. Were they even real? The Federal Trade Commission wants to make sure they are by banning fake reviews, finding those responsible, and making them pay for trying to fool us. Perhaps you have your own online review horror story to share or have a question about how the agency plans to put an end to the proliferation of fake reviews. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org anytime. Sam Levine is director of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection. And Sam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with how big of a problem this is, and do we even know how many fake reviews we can find online?
You know, it's an excellent question, and the fact is fake reviews are a scourge. We don't know the exact numbers because so many of these fake reviews are not detected, but based on our investigations over the last many years and our conversations with businesses across the economy, we believe there are millions of fake reviews out there, and that's exactly why we proposed a rule to try to crack down on them.
Yeah, our own state consumer protection agency compiles an annual list of the top 10 consumer complaints, and the list has yet to mention online fake reviews, hasn't even made the top 10. Is it that consumers are unaware that the reviews are fake online? What about from the consumer perspective, Sam?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. These fake reviews have become really sophisticated. And one thing I'll note is that the emergence of generative AI, generative artificial intelligence, is making it easier and easier to write very sophisticated fake reviews that read like they're from an actual person. So what we find is that consumers might complain about a product that's not good or a service that's not what they expected, and they might have purchased that product or service based on a fake review, but they might not actually know that that review was fake, yet they were still harmed by the practice.
So if we don't know the review is fake, and you're not sure, that the Federal Trade Commission's not sure how many fake reviews are actually out there online, how would we go about identifying them if we wanted to start cracking down on them?
Well, that's a great question, too. We do have at the FTC investigators. We have investigative tools. We hear from whistleblowers who tell us that the companies they're working for are suppressing negative reviews or drafting positive reviews. So we are often, as a government agency, in a better position to detect these reviews. That said, you're absolutely right. Not every review is going to be caught. And that's why one of the things we're doing with our rule proposal is really upping the ante for how much companies or individuals need to pay if they're involved in this practice. And what we're hoping that we'll do if the rule is finalized is send a strong message of deterrence so that people know that if they get caught, they're going to pay a heavy price.
So the Federal Trade Commission is proposing a new rule to stop companies from using deceptive or unfair online review practices. So, Sam, what does the agency consider to be deceptive or unfair in this rule proposal?
So we list a whole host of practices, and it kind of illustrates the creativity of many people involved in this industry. Some companies will just write fake reviews. Others will pay, you know, their family or they'll pay their customers to write positive reviews, even if the customers haven't used the product. Some companies will actually buy positive reviews. There are marketplaces for these reviews that companies can buy. Some companies will delete their negative reviews while highlighting their positive reviews. These practices are distinct, but all of them distort the marketplace by making it harder for consumers to ascertain whether a product or service is worth buying. And all of these practices are deceptive and are therefore covered by our proposed rule.
But what if a business asks its customers to leave them a review? Where do we draw the line?
That is not necessarily illegal. Okay. Where we draw the line is because especially for startup businesses who want to compete with incumbents, they might want to encourage consumers to write reviews so that they can compete more fairly. That said, if a company, you know, sends you a mailer or sends you an email and it says we'll give you $25 for posting a positive review, or, you know, we'll give you $25 for posting a negative review at one of our competitors, that's illegal and that would be covered by the rule.
We're talking about the Federal Trade Commission's new proposal to ban fake online reviews and fine people who are involved. Our guest is Sam Levine, director of the Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection, and you can join our conversation with your questions or your experiences at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sam, how are businesses responding to the proposal from the Commission?
Well, we're taking comments until September 29th, and I expect we're going to hear from a lot of businesses. I will tell you, we hear from a lot of companies that complain about fake reviews, because companies out there that are honest and that are offering a good product or a good service end up needing to compete with companies that cheat, companies that buy fake reviews or generate fake reviews, often to make their products or services look better than they actually are. So we really see this rule proposal as good not only for consumers, but also businesses that are honest, businesses that are playing by the rules and delivering value for their customers.
I would love to be able to trust what I find online, but increasingly I've learned that that might be difficult to do. So how can we go about restoring trust online, and will this take us, as you mentioned, you're not going to be able to find every fake online review, but you will be able to identify some. How can we restore trust here?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a real challenge, and I think a number of steps need to be taken. One, you know, we really encourage the major platforms to do more. They're often in the best position to identify these reviews. We really want them to do more to take down reviews on their own. That ultimately creates a better experience both for shoppers and for the businesses on the platform. But we also think our rule is going to make a big difference. Again, you're right. Not every fake review is going to be detected. But when companies realize and when individuals realize that if they engage in deceptive review practices, they could get sued in federal court and have to pay up to $50,000 per violation. And by the way, a violation every time someone sees the fake review, that can constitute a violation. So these numbers can add up really quickly. We hope that sends a strong message that it's just not worth it, that the price is too high to pay if they engage in this practice. So a big part of our strategic approach to this problem is deterrence.
Sam, that's $50,000 fine per eyes viewed, not per fake review?
That's correct. Now, obviously, it's going to depend on the fact of each case, but our statutory authority allows us to seek in federal court money for every time a consumer actually sees a fake review. So these numbers can add up very, very quickly. Now, that's a maximum fine, so it'll depend on the egregiousness of the practice, but these numbers can add up very, very quickly.
Well, I have a case here for last year. The Fashion Nova settled to pay the Federal Trade Commission over $4 million over allegations that it blocked negative reviews on its website. So it can add up very fast. What can you tell us about that case that would go towards your proposed new rule change?
Yeah, exactly. So what we allege that Fashion Nova did, and as you mentioned, Fashion Nova is a fashion retailer, is what we call review suppression. They posted their higher starred reviews and didn't post their negative reviews. And it doesn't take a mathematician to know that if you're posting a lot of five-star reviews and you're deleting a lot of one-star reviews, the aggregate review score for your company is going to be artificially inflated, and that harms consumers. So you're right, we took action against Fashion Nova. They paid out a significant judgment, and we're actually using that money we're returning money to consumers who might have been deceived by those practices. So that's a good illustration of how we've been able to use our existing authority to crack down on these practices. But the reality is that if this rule is finalized, and if other companies engage in similar practices, they could actually face much higher fines than what Fashion Nova paid.
Sam Levine is our guest. He is the director of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection with a new proposed rule to crack down on fake online reviews. And you can call in with a question or comment and join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking with the director of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection, Sam Levine. And we're looking at the agency's proposal to ban fake reviews and fine those responsible. What do you want to know about how the Federal Trade Commission plans to go about putting a stop to all these fake reviews? You can call in with your question or tell us a story. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Sam, you mentioned before that people can comment before September 29th on this proposal from the commission to ban fake reviews. How can people submit their feedback?
Yeah, so absolutely. What they can do is they can go to regulations.gov.gov, find the Federal Trade Commission's docket for the fake review rule, and file a comment. And, you know, we really encourage people to do this. I think there's maybe a perception or a myth that you have to be a lawyer or a lobbyist and kind of draft a very formal legal brief for us to pay attention. That's absolutely not true. We want to hear from ordinary people, members of the public who've been affected by these practices, have a view on how we should address them. You know, we get comments that are three sentences. They'll just say, yeah, we really like this rule. No, we don't. We will read every rule. They don't need to be written like a brief. And we really encourage public participation in our rulemaking. We don't want to hear only from kind of DC lobbyists. We want to hear from the public who's going to be most affected by this proposal.
And how do those comments go into the actions the Federal Trade Commission may or may not take going forward?
They're the heart of our decision-making process. Both by law and because it just makes sense, whether we finalize this rule is going to depend on the record we develop. And the record we develop is going to be based on the comments we get from the public. Our mission is to serve the public interest, so we're only going to move forward with this if it makes sense. And to ascertain that, it's really critical we hear from the public. So I certainly encourage your listeners, if they have a view on this, file a comment. It's not very difficult. We will read it, and it's a way you can help shape policy nationwide.
And that website, again, is regulations.gov?
That's it.
What would the timeline look like, Sam, from the Federal Trade Commission after the comment period ends September 29th? When could we find a decision about the commission's attempt to crack down on fake online reviews?
So because we read all of the comments, it really depends on the volume of comments we receive. Based on past experience, it's going to take at least a few months to review the comments and to comply with some of the other requirements under our rulemaking authority. But what I will say is that we see this as a really urgent problem. So we're going to move quickly in ascertaining whether this proposal makes sense because we know that the American public is frustrated with this problem and we want to use all of our tools to try to help out.
And how would this change our online experience, would you say, if these rules were put into place and it was and the rules were able to be enforced and fines were able to be levied? What would that mean for me, the consumer, as you see it?
Our hope is that this proposal will make for a more honest online marketplace. I think if you go back 10, 15 years ago or really longer for some people, at the dawn when people started using, buying stuff online, I think one of the things consumers like me really appreciated is that you could actually read reviews of the products and services you were buying. That kind of was an advantage over brick-and-mortar stores. You could see what other buyers of a product had to say about the product. But I think what we've seen in recent years is that the scourge of fake reviews has become so bad that people just don't place the same trust in reviews that they used to. And that's bad for everyone. People end up paying more for worse products. They end up returning those products. Companies that actually have good products out in the marketplace struggle to compete because it's hard to distinguish themselves. So what we would like to do through this rule, through this proposed rule, is just create a more honest marketplace so that consumers have more confidence when they're shopping online and businesses that are delivering value for the public can distinguish themselves and thrive in the marketplace.
So what would be some arguments against this rule proposal from the Federal Trade Commission to ban online fake reviews?
Well, I think we're going to get a lot of comments. And I'm sure there'll be some who oppose the rule. some who support the proposal, some who want us to modify it. You know, I don't want to speculate as to every argument. But, you know, from my perspective, and obviously we're going to take the comments very seriously before we finalize anything, but from my perspective, I really think that this proposal is both pro-business and pro-consumer for all the reasons I said. So we're certainly going to, you know, we want to hear from the public about things we might have missed or situations we might not have anticipated. But at the end of the day, we wouldn't have proposed this if we didn't think this would benefit everyone in the marketplace who plays by the rules.
That's Sam Levine, director of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Sam, last year, we started with our own state's consumer protection top 10 list of their concerns, and last year, telemarketing was the second highest consumer complaint here in Wisconsin, that according to our consumer protection agency. And starting October 1st, telemarketer fees will pay more. Telemarketer companies will pay more money to download a phone number from the Do Not Call registry. Why the hike in the fees?
So the hike in the fees is based on inflation. It's statutory, and when you know, the prices of other goods and services go up, the fees go up as well.
And Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call and other state attorneys general are seeking to reduce illegal robocalls. And in July, Josh Call spoke on the morning show about illegal telemarketing, putting more people at risk for scams. Here he is.
Because the volume of these robocalls is so high, if even a small percentage of those end up being successful in causing a scam to move forward, that's a lot of people's lives that are impacted who are victimized through this process.
Sam, do we know how telemarketers are accessing phone numbers illegally?
Yeah, you know, it's an excellent question, and General Call is absolutely right. We announced over the summer the largest telemarketing crackdown in U.S. history. We worked with more than 100 enforcers, state attorneys general across the country, U.S. attorneys, Department of Justice, Federal Communications Commission, and we announced more than 180 actions against illegal telemarketing. And one of the things we highlighted is that one key way that telemarketers are getting around or trying to get around the Do Not Call protections and trying to blast people with robocalls is a practice called consent forms. This is an interesting concept. What companies are doing, and by the way, these are major companies that are engaging in these practices. One of the companies we sued was publicly traded. They have websites online that make it look like they're job application websites. So they'll post ads that say you want a job as a delivery driver, making $18 an hour. Fill out your information here. So a lot of consumers who are looking for work fill out this information, understandably. But what these companies don't tell you is that they're not actually connecting you with the job. They are harvesting your information and selling it to telemarketers who then blast you with calls, often fraudulent calls. So, you know, I think there's a perception that telemarketing is just, you know, people in a boiler room making calls. It's actually a much more sophisticated ecosystem of both telemarketers and companies that enable them. And the crackdown that we announced this summer is really intended to go after every part of that ecosystem to make sure that we can reduce the scourge of unwanted calls.
There is a three-part documentary on the streaming service Max called Telemarketers, documenting a telemarketing company for more than a decade ago now. And it, while some of it's on the level, other parts of it certainly seem to be something that a consumer protection would be interested in enforcing. And how else is the Federal Trade Commission seeking to reduce illegal telemarketing? Marketing, Sam.
Well, you're absolutely right about that documentary, and actually, the documentary is about a case that the FTC brought. More than my predecessor David Vladek was interviewed on it. So we're certainly proud of the work we've done, but I know that Americans feel this problem is not going away. Here's the good news: we are, as both at the Federal Trade Commission and state attorneys general. We are really broadening our approach to this problem. We're not only, as I said, challenging the telemarketers themselves, we're challenging big companies. You know, one of the companies we sued, one of these consent farms, sold 660 million leads meaning the personal information of 660 million consumers.
Wow.
To telemarketers. We are really trying to move upstream to stop these actors to really crack down on this problem. We've also pursued what are called VoIP providers. These are the companies that sit between overseas telemarketers and American consumers. So
and
if you're in another country, go ahead.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, but there is more to talk about. And thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's been a pleasure, and I certainly urge your listeners to weigh in on our rulemaking with comments. We welcome the public's input.
Sam Levine, Director of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this summer, biologists in Wisconsin completed a years-long survey of the population of wood turtles. The threatened species live mostly in the North Woods, and as Rob Menser reports, wood turtles have been in decline as they lost nests to predators and as humans poach turtles to sell illegally. The shell of a wood turtle has distinctive line markings, almost like the rings of a tree. They're pretty small turtles, about 8 inches long, and wood turtles are in trouble.
We're good?
It's a cool Northwoods morning in May, and a group of about a dozen people are on a field trip sponsored by the nonprofit Natural Resources Foundation. The plan is to kayak down a river where scientists from the Department of Natural Resources are conducting a population survey of wood turtles. Andrew Badgie is a conservation biologist. On a car ride to the kayak launch, he says the wood turtle is in trouble.
A lot of the nesting habitat no longer is natural in the state, and so a lot of the wood turtles the females will actually nest along the roadsides. And that's just a really easy avenue for raccoons and other predators to dig up the nests.
Wisconsin classifies wood turtles as a threatened species. This year, the DNR shared its latest population survey data with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They'll decide whether or not wood turtles should qualify as a federally endangered species. That decision is expected next spring. These turtles have distinctive lined markings, almost like the rings of a tree. Badgie says that's made them attractive to another predator, poachers.
Where people will go into sites and basically collect as many wood turtles as they possibly can and sell them illegally across the seas in China and Southeast Asia and even in the United States and Europe.
In 2020, the Malaysian government extradited a Chinese citizen to the U.S. He was found to be running a multi-million-dollar international turtle smuggling ring. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Badgie asked that WPR not give the exact location of the nesting sites to keep the information out of poachers' hands. The group paddles down the river, hoping to catch a glimpse of turtles sunning themselves. They stop at a shelter the DNR built to try to protect wood turtle nests from predators. Biologist Lena Carlson explains.
It's made out of wood. It's surrounded by chicken wire. However, at the very bottom, there is a gap, probably the size of a 2x4, which is the exact height of a wood turtle. So only wood turtles can get in this box, and only wood turtles can get out of it.
Turtles are just coming out of hibernation in May. By June, they'll be looking for places to nest, and biologists hope they'll find these sites more attractive than the roadsides. Surveying the turtles is time-consuming and tricky. They don't just line up to be counted. There's a thunderstorm in the forecast today. Turtles can sense changes in barometric pressure, and they've made themselves scarce.
You want to check this one?
Sure.
A few weeks later, another biologist, Carly Lapin, is out surveying nest sites not far from that same river. This time, there's no group of tourists. She and a trainee dig out some nests so they can count the number of eggs before carefully replacing them. She says the threat to this species from the illegal pet trade is very real.
The females congregate in these, like, nesting areas every spring, so it's really easy for someone to just go and grab a bunch of female turtles, and they can wipe out a whole population, you know, in one night.
Lapin wears mosquito netting as we hike through swampy areas and along sandy roads where wood turtles like to nest. Deep in the woods, we spot one. The turtle is digging in the sand with her back legs. Lapin says she's just picking out her nest site.
So she's not nesting yet. She's digging a hole.
Lapin takes down some data about the turtle and the nesting site. Now that we've disturbed her, Lapin says this turtle will probably wait at least a few hours before laying her eggs. It's already illegal to hunt or take wood turtles from the wild. If the species is granted federally endangered status, that would mean more funding for research and conservation efforts like these. Scientists say that's needed to keep the wood turtle population from dwindling further. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and there are a lot of lingering questions about the future of the Milwaukee Brewers. They're currently in first place in their division, but can they be formidable playoff contenders? And what's the future of their longtime manager, Craig Counsell, a hometown hero who's led the team since 2015 and is now in the last year of his contract? And why are we hearing rumblings about the Brewers picking up stakes and leaving the city they've called home since 1970? Perhaps you have some questions of your own, or maybe even some answers. Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, J.R. Radcliffe, is a sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thank you for having me back. Happy to be here.
3.5 games ahead of the Chicago Cubs in the National League Central Division. That's where our Milwaukee Brewers currently stand. And where does their current standing, with about a month left to go in the regular season, compare to where we were with the preseason expectations, JR?
I would say this is just about right. This lead that they have, it doesn't sound like a big one, but it's matched for the biggest lead that any National League Central team has had this year. Nobody has really taken the reins and run with it. Now the Cubs have been really, really good lately, the last few weeks. The Cincinnati Reds are still right there. They're percentage points behind the Cubs, but also technically 3.5 back after yesterday. So it's going to be a situation that comes down to the last couple weeks of the season. The Brewers have a huge series at Wrigley Field coming up next week. That's gonna be big, and also play the Cubs the last three games of the season at American Family Field. So that could have colossal impact depending on where we are in the standings. So they came into the year with kind of questions on offense, pretty solid pitching. I would say that's been borne out almost exactly. And the way they've played lately has been pretty encouraging for Brewers fans. So this is about where I guess we thought they would be.
Before winning 5 in a row following a 10th inning walk-off game-melting win yesterday at American Family Field, the Brewers dropped 3 in a row to the Los Angeles Dodgers. Dodgers in first place in the West. You've got the Atlanta Braves in the first place in the East. How do the Brewers compare to the other first-place teams in the National League, JR?
Well, that's a pretty big question, because if the Brewers want to get to a World Series, there's a pretty good chance, there's a really strong chance they'll have to face one of those two teams, and a pretty good chance they'll have to face both of them. And those two teams have kind of kicked Milwaukee around a little bit this year. I think it's 2-10 they are overall. They got swept in Atlanta, they got swept at the LA Dodgers, and you know, there were flashes of they kind of got unlucky in Los Angeles a little bit. Corbin Burns had an outstanding pitching performance that was wasted because the offense couldn't score any runs. Offensively, they just didn't do anything in that series, and that is alarming, because the Dodgers are kind of the gold standard along with the Braves, but that's a team that the Brewers have kind of been chasing here as they've been in this phase where they're one of the better teams in the National League. And the Brewers weren't able to mount enough offense. That's kind of been their story this year. Offensively, it's come in fits and starts. You know, the crazy thing is they went right from LA to Texas against another first place team, and then swept Texas and pounded the ball around the ballpark. They had big leads going into the ninth inning of every one of those games. But against LA, they weren't able to do anything. I think they only had, I want to say, 10 hits over three games, which is really, ooh, really not enough. So they're going to have to figure something out. What you can say is that they haven't really thrown a lot of their top pitchers against the Dodgers or the Braves, not many times this year in a short series, in a short playoff series. It would stack up a little differently. The randomness of the playoffs tells you that you can't really use the regular season as your guide on how things will go. So there's not a ton of predictive value, but it does bear notice that the Brewers have not been good against those teams this season.
And JR, what did the Brewers do around the trade deadline to improve their roster? And how do you assess their improvements compared to what it's going to take to get past the Braves and Dodgers, were they to make it to the playoffs?
So they made a bunch of moves at around the deadline. They added three guys to the big league roster. One is first baseman Carlos Santana, who's a veteran. He's been around a long time. He's hit some pretty big home runs since he's gotten here. Overall, numbers not great offensively. I think he's just okay. Sound defensively, which is something the Brewers really love. Their defense is really one of the strengths of the team. So he's the guy who's kind of the everyday first baseman. In the outfield, you've got Mark Canna. He comes from the New York Mets. He's been okay. He's had a couple key hits as well. Again, not like he doesn't dramatically change the landscape of things for the Brewers, but he's fine. And they added a relief pitcher named Andrew Chafin from the Arizona Diamondbacks. Andrew Chafin has struggled a little bit so far. So they've really had this run where guys they trade for that are relief pitchers at the deadline, really since 2019. Those guys have been pretty bad. Just sort of, it's just this little miniature curse they're dealing with right now. So there's I guess some hope, plenty of time, and it's a very small sample, plenty of time for Andrew Chafin to turn it around. They also traded away Luis Arias, who was their everyday third baseman, to Boston for a nice minor league pitcher, but they've really struggled finding a third baseman this year, a consistent one. First base, I guess, as well, has been sort of a spot offensively that they haven't gotten full production out of. So they made some upgrades, and it's just going to take the guys to beat Atlanta and LA. It's going to take the guys they've got. There are no more roster moves to be made. There's not really guys in the minors that you could expect making a difference at this point. The guys they have just have to start hitting the ball a lot better, and everything else is kind of in place at this point. So guys like Willy Adames, who's been rounding into form the last few games here, they have to hit the ball. and if they do, they have a shot.
Jarrett Radcliffe, our guest, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel sports reporter, and you can join the conversation on the Milwaukee Brewers at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. I saw in the Atlantic yesterday that there was talk that the Milwaukee Brewers could acquire Pete Alonso from the New York Mets. Pete Alonso, a first baseman, which you mentioned is a need for the Brewers. They ended up getting Mark Canna from the Mets instead, which you also alluded to, but he's a third in the major league in home runs. Why would they, and considering that they didn't end up getting Pete Alonso because they would have had to, I would assume, give up too much for him. And that's certainly an interesting contrast compared to the rookies that the Milwaukee Brewers have. One of them, Bryce Terang, walked it off yesterday in the win against the Minnesota Twins.
Yeah, that report from Ken Rosenthal in The Athletic, yeah. He said that it was... He said that the two sides that he spoke to disputed as to how close that deal was. His source on the Brewers side said it was pretty close. The Mets side, maybe not so much. So I'm not, no one's really clear on how those talks progressed. Getting Pete Alonso would have been a huge, huge addition. It would have been one of the biggest swings, probably the biggest swing they've taken at the trade deadline since 2008 when they acquired CC Sabathia. You know, you don't get that level of offense, let alone from a guy who's 28 years old, who's would still be under contract next season. You don't get that at the trade deadline. And yeah, it would have cost a top prospect, you know, not necessarily the Brewers' number one prospect, a guy by the name of Jackson Churio, who's one of the biggest prospects in baseball, but it would have cost a really nice player. I don't think the Brewers would have been the one to balk at that deal, though. I think that's probably the Mets deciding they weren't quite prepared to part with a talent like Pete Alonso. But that would have been exactly the guy that would have been a huge upgrade. That would have made this team a serious contender for the World Series. These upgrades around the edges, the team could still be that. There's still a team that can actually win the World Series. A lot has to fall into place, but it's possible. Getting Alonso would have been a game changer, though. That would have been a really, really big deal. Yeah. I personally wonder how close that deal really was, but if you know, it's the Brewers have often been discussed. They've all often told us that they were really close to getting a big level talent at the deadline. We just, you know, you haven't seen it in a couple recent years, but you know, maybe this one was really close.
J.R. Radcliffe, our guest sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, taking a look at the Milwaukee Brewers, taking a look at their short-term and long-term future when we continue with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're looking at the immediate and long-term future of the Milwaukee Brewers with our guest, J.R. Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. JR, what about the changes to Major League Baseball this year with pitchers on a pitch clock this year, bigger bases, and a limited number of pickoff attempts for runners on bases? How have the Brewers reacted to the rule changes?
I think everybody is pretty much used to them by now. It didn't take long. There wasn't really a very long acclimation process, but it definitely seems to have improved things, made the game a lot more fan-friendly. You'll see attendance is up across baseball. The Brewers have seen an uptick in attendance as well. Some of that can just be explained by slowly but surely everybody sort of returning to their normal schedule post-pandemic, but it's definitely livened things up a little bit. There was just a lot of dead time in the game of baseball, and we gotten to a point where, you know, if you went to a game, you probably had to imagine it was going to be 3.5 hours at least. Now you can almost safely assume you're going to be out of there in 3 hours. There are games that go over that, of course, but it moves very, very quickly. It's a very fan-friendly experience. It's made base running more of a cat and mouse game because pitchers are limited to the number of times they can sort of disengage, is the word, step off the mound, and during an at-bat, they're limited to two of those instances before a runner gets to move up a base if a pitcher does that again. So there is a little bit of strategy element to it, but everybody's kind of acclimated to that. It's really just a much more quick, the game just moves more quickly.
And some of the changes, the elimination of the defensive shift, where you were not allowed to overload a certain side of the field with defensive players. And the stat I heard yesterday during the Brewers game, after 127 games, the Brewers have only had 3 sacrifices all season. That's a huge change now that you have a designated hitter in the National League.
Yeah, so I think that it was kind of expected that the shift wouldn't really dramatically change things. The idea was to create more base hits, make it a little more difficult for defenses to just kind of shut down pull hitters anytime they put the ball on the ground. And I would say that's probably happened to some degree, but I think you're finding pretty nominal changes as far as offense goes because of the shift defensively. I mean, yeah, there's a few base hits that get through that wouldn't have gotten through in years past, but I think for the most part, we're seeing things pretty similar to the way they are before. Teams have adjusted to this pretty quickly. And, you know, quite honestly, when you have defenses like the Brewers, where you've got a second baseman in Bryce Durang and a shortstop like Willy Adames, who could cover so much ground, it doesn't really matter. They're just good enough to get to the ball pretty much wherever they are. You know, they move as far as they can, and then they still get to the baseball. So that's an advantage that the Brewers have. They have such a really good middle infield defense. So as far as sacrifices go, those have been deep decline for a long time. The Brewers are not a team that puts the ball that bunts. They don't like to throw away at bats that way. That's sort of a kind of gone the way of the dinosaur in Major League Baseball. It maybe still works on a lower level, but in the big leagues, those can be fielded well enough where you're essentially surrendering an out. Teams just don't like to do that.
I don't remember in my lifetime as many changes as Major League Baseball has gone through in the last few years. You expect those changes to stay the same? And do you see more changes ahead in the future for the game?
I think the commissioner, Rob Manfred, is really open-minded about stuff. And he gets a lot of pushback for that. A lot of, you know, baseball's a game of tradition and statistics, mm-hmm. and you're going to have a lot of people who are purists, so to speak, that don't like the idea of tinkering with the rules at all. These are pretty dramatic changes to how we understand baseball. You know, we haven't had pitch clocks, obviously, in baseball growing up, playing it in sandlots and things like that. But I think he's just willing to mess around with it if it makes sense. And if it makes sense, that means does it help make the product as good as it possibly can be? And so I do think he'll continue to tinker. I don't think we'll see anything quite to this level, what we saw this past season with so many changes implemented at the same time. But the big one on the horizon is whether or not they can implement an automated strike ball system, essentially robo-umps for shorthand, find a way to get some more consistent umpiring behind the plate. The minor leagues have experimented with things like a challenge system where you can kind of quickly say, you called that a strike, but I think it was a ball, and they quick look at it and are able to implement that new, whatever the call is, very quickly. I don't know if baseball's headed that direction. They've certainly been working on it. They're still tinkering with it though. They haven't found, sort of like automated cars, they haven't found a system that really seems to suit what people are looking for. So, but that is something that's definitely in the conversation going forward.
J.R. Radcliffe, our guest from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Whitefish Bay High School graduate Craig Counsell's managed the Milwaukee Brewers since 2015, but he's in his last year of his contract. Do you expect the Brewers to keep Craig Counsell past this season, J.R.?
I actually don't, and it wouldn't be the Brewers' decision. It would be Craig Counsell's decision, and they've made that very clear that he's welcome to come back basically if he wants. His success is kind of unquestionable, I think. I mean, he's the longest tenured manager in the National League Central. They've had a ton of success under him. Obviously, a hometown guy, like you said. I think the Brewers would have him back in a heartbeat. The question is, does he want to come back? He's got kids now in college playing college sports. You know, he's been doing this a while. I could certainly envision a scenario where he takes some time off or goes to a front office job, which is what he was doing before he became manager. So I don't know if people are really aware that that's kind of coming, but it really feels to me, everything we've heard and seen, that this is probably it for him by his own accord. He may decide otherwise, you know, but I think he's got all the chips here, and I think it'll just be what he decides to do at the end of the year.
What about the future of the franchise in Milwaukee? Brewers officials are saying they may begin contemplating moving to another city if state and local authorities fail to reach some funding agreement for American Family Field. What would the Brewers moving mean for the city?
This is such a nuanced discussion. I don't think I have time, looking at the clock here, to sort of dive deep enough into it. What I would say is that there are always going to be whispers, because financing stadiums is a tricky business. It's expensive. It doesn't, you know, you don't just build a stadium and then don't have to keep financing it. There's all this upkeep. Certainly we're seeing that with American Family Field. And then you have the owners have found a way to get governments involved so that they don't have to foot the entire bill themselves, so that some of that stuff can get paid for. In Wisconsin, it seems like both sides of the aisle are interested in making that happen. It's just a matter of the details and who's going to pay for what and which governments are going to pay for what. There is a contract between the state of Wisconsin and the Brewers relating to American Family Field. So there's a lot going on. What I would say is, big picture, I wouldn't be worried about it happening. The climate, the way Major League Baseball is, the league is going to be much more motivated to see this league expand than they are seeing a team relocate. It's a better financial move for them, and that's going to put a Brewers situation on the back burner. They're not interested in moving a team, especially with the fan turnout they get in Milwaukee. They're not interested in moving that team if they can help it. So could they move someday? Yes, they absolutely could. The owner could decide, you know what, I'm picking up stakes, I want to go to Nashville. I don't think that's likely. It's certainly not going to happen in the next couple of years, and I really don't think that's where we're headed. I think the situation is just too good in Milwaukee right now.
JR, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. Anytime.
JR Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent this morning, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.